said Wells and the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as we promised last week, we're going to move on to look at the 10 most important political events of 2019. Last week, we talked about the 10 most important economic events in the U.S., for the U.S., and today we're going to look at the 10 most important, looking back on 2019, political events for the U.S. If we have time, I would like to also move on and talk about the past decade, both economics and politics. Let's put the past decade in perspective, but we may not have time for that, and we'll leave that for next week. As we try to take assessment here of what's been going on in the last decade, the last year, U.S. global, political, economic, as we enter this very important 2020 junctural year here for the U.S. and the world, both politically and economically. I'm going to talk first about the Trump events of the past week in Iran, the near war with Iran, and my analysis of that, share that with you. You can read my print versions of this. I wrote three articles last week as these developments occurred. They're available on my blog, jackrasmus.com. You can also read them on Global Research, ZNet, Counterpunch, and places like that. The first one, first piece I wrote was, has the U.S. crossed the escalation to war Rubicon, you might say? That was the first piece when things developed immediately. And then I followed up with U.S. Trump's deja vu wartime playbook. How the U.S. goes to war, very typically in the post-war period, in the age of empire, and now the latter stage of empire. It's interesting to see there's a pattern here, there's a formula, and Trump has been following it with regard to Iran. And then the most latest piece here, as the confrontation between the two appeared to settle down a little bit. My latest piece was about provocations. U.S. provocations of Iran are not over. They will continue, as Iran is a very convenient political punching bag in election year for Trump. I don't think he wants a war, although he would gladly accept one, I think, if Iran makes the mistake and takes the U.S. bait and responds in kind militarily to the U.S. Trump's fine with that, too, in an election year. But I think what he really wants is to keep the provocations going. Every time Iran does not respond in kind, well, that's a win-win for him, too. Makes him look tough, makes them look like they're backing down and backing off, and he looks strong, and it gives him a foreign policy win short-term, not as great as maybe a war, although that could be, the 11th hour surprise here if he's way behind in the polls or something in October. But I think he wants just what he got. He's waited until the last year to pull the plug on this whole strategy with Iran. So let's talk about Trump versus Iran, which is really a story that begins in 2019 as well. because although the incident occurs here with the assassination of this general and senior diplomat Soleimani, for Iran early in the first days of January 2020, it really begins in December and probably earlier than that. The U.S. had been escalating its provocations against Iran throughout December, the latter part of December. We'll talk about that. So this thing was in the works. It just didn't occur overnight, the decision to assassinate and events leading up to it. The decision was not just a singular event separated from other events that were beginning to occur. It's part of a bigger picture here of Trump in as he enters an election year and as impeachment proceedings and trials begin to really ratchet up the foreign policy crisis for various reasons we'll talk about. Okay. So let's talk about this whole event. And, you know, listeners should keep in mind that this is a typical U.S. wartime playbook, as I say in the article. Well, what do I mean by that? Right? Well, if you look at all the wars in the post-war period, especially since Vietnam and after, the U.S. follows a certain strategy. When it wants to go to war, it engages in a provocation, and it covers it with a lie. There's always a provocation, and there's always a lie to cover the event. And if the opponent, adversary, target country, right, responds to the provocation aggressively or totally ignores it sometimes, then that creates the justification for the U.S. to issue a demand on the target country that it cannot accept. Obviously, an important demand that is unacceptable. And when the target country does not accept the demand, well, then that's the excuse the U.S. gives. Well, you know, they won't negotiate or talk to us about our demand. So we have no alternative but to go to war militarily. So provocation followed by an unacceptable demand is the formula that the U.S. Uses. Let's look at Vietnam, okay? Well, what was the provocation? And the lie, because usually it's associated with a lie, well, Tonkin Gulf, right? The U.S., LBJ, 1964, you know, points to the Tonkin Gulf. What was that? For those of you who weren't around or hadn't read about it, well, that was a totally fabricated event where the president, LBJ, argued that, Vietnamese patrol boats had attacked U.S. destroyers. That's the provocation that was used for the U.S. then to ramp up hundreds of thousands of soldiers and military forces that the U.S. then sent to Vietnam in 65, right? It was Tonkin Gulf. They attacked us first, right? Well, it turned out Pentagon Papers never happened. It was a total fabrication. The photos brought out were totally fabricated. There was no attack whatsoever. The U.S. followed that up with unacceptable demands on Vietnamese. One was the Viet Cong had to stand down, disband itself, and the North Vietnam had to accept as permanent the two-state solution, which was engineered by the U.S., by the way. Vietnam was supposed to have a democratic election, and that was even agreed to by the U.S., but then the U.S. prevented the election, which North Vietnam would have won, the communists would have won, overwhelmingly unifying the country. So the U.S. demand was, you know, you got to accept, there'll be no election, you got to accept the fact that there will be a permanent two-state solution. That was the unacceptable demand that followed the Tonkin Gulf declaration event. And, of course, when the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong would not accept that, the U.S. invaded. All right. Wartime playbook. Gulf War. Same thing happens. What precipitates the Gulf War, the lie, and the provocation was, Saddam invaded Kuwait, look at all the incubator babies that were killed. Yeah, if you were around then, you remember on the media, we saw this woman showing these busted incubators for the babies, declaring these babies were killed by Saddam, right? Well, it turned out later that was a total fabrication as well, the person, the woman showing the busted incubators was really a member of the Kuwaiti royal elite family, and she was the one that was involved with the lie that these incubators were involved. Well, from then, you know, public opinion totally supported it, the invasion, and George H.W. Bush, Daddy Bush, demanded Saddam withdraw from Kuwait and create I don't know how many miles of a buffer zone, pull back his forces from the Kuwaiti-Iraqi border and Saudi border, that the U.S. International be allowed to inspect all the military bases and so forth in Iraq. In other words, a demand that could not be accepted. When it wasn't accepted, of course, then the forces began to mobilize, and we had the invasion of Iraq, the first one. Okay. By the way, there's the story. Some argue it wasn't true or not, but there was the story that the U.S. ambassador I'm not sure it was Kuwait or Iraq, had a conversation authorized by George Bush with Saddam, saying it was okay. The U.S. would not intervene if Saddam invaded Kuwait. If true, then clearly, you know, Saddam was set up. We know the rest of that story, if it's true. Okay, there's debates whether that was true or not. That's the provocation and the demand that can't be accepted led to the first Gulf War. Okay, fast forward to 9/11 and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. Bin Laden, of course, had the dirty hands, and he was safely ensconced there in Afghanistan. But the U.S. position was that the Taliban was responsible. The Taliban was allied with bin Laden here in 9/11. So Afghanistan plus Al-Qaeda were responsible for 9/11. That was the lie. And the demand was they had to give up not only bin Laden, but all these other foreign mercenaries and foreign mujahideen or whatever, turn them loose and turn them over to the United States, or else the U.S. would invade. Well, you know, if the Taliban did that, it would have been an internal civil war. Could not accept that. And when it didn't, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan. Taliban had nothing to do with 9/11. And in fact, the Saudis had a lot to do with 9/11 because, 18 of the 20 terrorists who flew into the buildings in New York and in the Pentagon were Saudi nationals. They were from Saudi Arabia. There were big pictures in the press of the origins of all these guys right after. And the U.S. did nothing to its strategic friend, the king there, the monarch of Saudi Arabia. And in fact, George Bush put all seniors, Saudi nationals, on a special plane the next day after 9/11, flew them back to Saudi Arabia. And we still don't know who was on that plane, right? So they clearly were protecting the Saudis, and, you know, we should have pursued what's the connection here, right? The Saudis have something to do with 9/11. Oh, no, we created the fiction that it was Saddam and everything to do with 9/11. Which brings us to the Iraq War. You know, in the Iraq War, we have General Powell, who was ambassador to the UN, showing his charts about yellow cake, which was necessary, a rudimentary element for making uranium, and showing that there were weapons of mass destruction in these buildings in Iraq. So, you know, that was the lie, and the provocation was the U.S. Demanding, and the U.S. demanded that Saddam allow U.S. forces into Iraq to inspect its military bases, even though Atomic Energy International, UN Atomic Energy Commission inspectors had already inspected widely the various sites in Iraq and decided there were no WMDs. The U.S. And George W. Bush would not accept that because they had decided to go to war. I remember reading in the Wall Street Journal and other sources here in December of 2001. In other words, just a few months after 9/11, the drumbeat was being was growing that, oh, invade Iraq, invade Iraq. And George Bush had already identified what he called the axis of evil countries, Syria, Iraq, Libya, and North Korea. Now, that was the axis of evil, and they were going after them one way or another. You know, Gaddafi in Libya had given up, voluntarily given up, all his development of nuclear arms. Well, that didn't save him from Hillary. In any event, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, same pattern all the time, an offer you can't refuse. I mean, you have to refuse, you can't accept, and a provocation. Mm-hmm. You know, light versions of this were also evident here with Bill Clinton's air attack on Bosnia, on Serbia, rather, in the Bosnian War. U.S. forces didn't go in, but it was sufficient just to pound the hell out of Serbia and get it to concede. And then Hillary does the same thing. It's documented. Hillary goes to Obama and wants to take action. She's Secretary of State at the time against Libya and Gaddafi because she needs a foreign policy victory in order to run for president in 2016. And Obama gives her that green light. And the U.S. You know, sends in scores of cruise missiles and other attack, air attack again. You know, that's the light version of all this, Libya and Bosnia. But all of these events, Vietnam, first Gulf War, Afghanistan, second Gulf War, Iraq, in other words, they all have the same pattern here. And one is a provocation, a bald-faced lie, and a demand that can't be accepted, and if the response is in kind from the adversary, then that's the escalation and invasion. If the response does not forthcome, well, then that is justification for invasion as well. That's the way America goes to war. That's the U.S. wartime playbook in the era of the late empire. Okay, so what do we see here with Iran? Well, we see the beginning of the same playbook, really. If you think about it, what was the provocation? Well, the assassination of the senior general and diplomat here, Soleimani. I think I pronounced that right, Soleimani. That was the provocation, very clearly. Well, did that just come out of the blue? Did they just decide for no reason to kill this guy in Iraq? No. You know, the argument, the justification, which is the weakest of all these post-war provocations and invasions and attacks by the U.S., the weakest, was that, Soleimani was planning an imminent attack, imminent attack. And that's why Trump said he had to do it. Well, no evidence has been given. In fact, when Trump finally did have Pompeo brief Congress, he was supposed to do it before. He did not, which is a break from precedent and a technical violation of the War Powers Act. He did it, and then after Congress raised hell, he had to give Congress a briefing. Well, he gave him a briefing, but the reports in the press were the briefing was so minimal, so poor, that it incensed members of Congress. Even conservatives like Rand Paul and I think it's Jim Lee of Utah even went on the media and said, this was disgusting. This was a violation of the Constitution. Well, Pompeo and others, they gave a few minutes. They let only about 10 or so of the senators to ask a question, and then they cut it off and ran away, you see. They had no proof of any imminent attack. Well, the other argument is that, Soleimani had killed hundreds of Americans. Well, that argument boils down to the assertion that it was Soleimani and the Iranians that gave the terrorists or whatever in Iraq the IEDs, right, that killed many Americans, those explosive devices on the road and so forth, right? Well, the IEDs and the attack on American forces there was mostly done by Sunnis, not by Iran and Soleimani. It was the Sunnis who were composed largely of unemployed Iraqi army and Revolutionary Guards that were thrown out of a job when the U.S. came in and disbanded it, and other disaffected forces. That, they were Sunnis. They weren't Shia, which is, Iraq, pro-Iraq. Now, I'm not saying that the Shia didn't do anything malicious, but, it wasn't Soleimani. In fact, Soleimani, you don't get the analysis in U.S. press, but the Soleimani mobilized the militias later was central in defeating ISIS, in Iraq. It wasn't the U.S. forces. It was Soleimani mobilizing and sort of the hero of defeating ISIS, by the way. Oh, but you don't hear that very much. Okay. So, the argument that Soleimani was doing this against Americans in the past and was planning a big attack on the embassy, absolutely no proof whatsoever. The U.S., there is some evidence now coming out. The U.S. was staging provocations, a series of provocations in December, provoking them, attacking and provoking the militias. And that's why the militias had this big protest and demonstration against the U.S. embassy and broke into the outer limits of the embassy, right? They just didn't do that all of a sudden and said, well, it's the end of the year. Let's go jump all over the walls of the U.S. embassy. No, there was provocations going on. And it will come out, what was the role of the U.S. in provoking those militias? Why did it provoke them? What was the U.S. role behind the assault on the U.S. embassy? And from there in that assault, the U.S. Maintains that Soleimani steps in and was planning with the militias an even bigger attack on the U.S. embassy, hence we need to kill him. Even John Bolton tweeted at the time that, the planning to kill Soleimani was underway for weeks already. And the smoking gun is, as Trump wanted to provoke a foreign policy crisis here for election purposes, I think. It's an election year. He hadn't accomplished anything in foreign policy. He wanted to show he was tough. His trade war, policy, although that's economic, was really a joke when you look at it behind the scenes, as I've been doing and talking and writing about. So he had nothing. He achieved nothing with North Korea. He couldn't succeed in overturning the Maduro government in Venezuela. He had nothing he could crow about in foreign policy in the election. Well, I think he's always kept Iran in his back pocket, and the plan from the very beginning when he came into office was to set up Iran for a tough crisis here right before the election. And I think, you know, he started implementing that and pulling the plug on Iran, right? You got to look at, you know, why was it that Trump insisted in the National Defense Authorization Act to exempt any military response against Iraq? You know, that NDAA was passed in early December. And that section was purposely, the limits on going after Iran were taken out. In other words, he opened the door, according to the NDAA, and of course he's used the Authorization for Military Force Resolution of 2002, which was only limited to Iraq, not Iran. But he's used that, and the fact the NDAA no longer limited him as the excuse, legal excuse, to assassinate Soleimani. Okay. So what we got here, it was a provocation, kill the guy, right? Justifications based on a lie, two lies, you know, both planning imminent threat, no evidence, and that he was responsible directly, Soleimani, for the deaths of hundreds of Americans during the uprising there after 2003. None of that. And, you know, the demand unacceptable by the U.S. Hasn't been forthcoming yet. We don't know what that demand's going to be. You see, we got the provocation, but we don't have the unacceptable demand. But Trump clearly was hoping, betting on Iran to respond as aggressively and militarily. But Iran did not take the bait. You see, cleverly, I think they knew what was going on here. And instead of escalating the whole process, they shoot off about 12 missiles, short-range missiles. And by some magic, you know, those short-range missiles don't kill anybody. They aim them at two bases, and no one is killed. And in fact, I find it suspicious that we don't even get photos of the damage of those bases. You know, it must have been very minimal or none at all. And I find it hard to believe that Iranian missile batteries just can't target those large bases if they really want to. And there's even some talk that Iran may have given some backdoor signals to the U.S. that the missiles were coming. Okay. Anyway, there's virtually no damage and no deaths by those missiles. A very minimal measured response. Iran did not take the bait and really escalate. And in fact, when they showed off the missiles, what did they say? They said, well, that's the end of it. We've concluded our response. And then, of course, Iran goes back and, you know, exaggerates the missiles' effects to its home base because, you know, the Iranian people were incensed and they wanted some countermeasures, you know. I'm sure they're being told that the damage was extensive and people were killed and so forth, but none of that actually happened. So the Iranian elites respond very minimally. They don't take Trump's bait and escalate, which puts Trump in a win-win situation, you know. It looks like by being tough and assassinating this guy, not only did he prevent imminent deaths, but he made the Iranians stand down, right? Which he did. He looks tough, right? And it's the kind of foreign policy action that appeals to a lot of his red state-based folks, you know? So he looks good short term in an election year, you see. If Iran had taken the bait in a major way, Well, then he would have escalated for sure, and he would have looked tough as well, tough again. And he would have his war that would completely distract from the impeachment whole process here and give him a nice boost foreign policy going into the election year. Right? Now, clearly, as I suggested earlier, he bypassed the War Powers Act. He didn't go to Congress and even brief them, at least even the heads of committees that he was going, what he was going to do. And that's a violation of the War Powers Act, right? And however, if Iran had responded aggressively, then this whole debate that's going on now about the War Powers Act and Democrats trying to strengthen it would have been totally forgotten. He would have gotten away with it and gotten around it, and the War Powers Act would essentially be null and void here. The discussion would be about the war going on and the next steps. Of course, that would have ended all the impeachment process pretty much. And the fact that Iran did not take the bait means that, well, now he's got to deal with this this burr under his hat here of trying to strengthen the War Powers Act, put some limits on his action going forward here. But he can handle that, you know. That's an easy thing to deal with because the War Powers Act is pretty much pro-president action. It's an abrogation of Congress's constitutional obligation to declare war. You know, we haven't declared a war since 1941, according to the Constitution. All these wars in the U.S., including the Korean War, have been started by presidents without the support of the Constitution. Okay, so what are the motivations? This isn't about oil, you know? I mean, a lot of folks on the left say, oh, it's all about oil, it's all about oil. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. You know, the U.S. doesn't want Iran to dominate the Middle East oil, but, you know, there's no threat of that going on. The U.S., you know, still has hegemony over global energy supplies, and the U.S. itself does not need oil. It's got such a surplus of oil and natural gas now, it's desperately trying to sell it abroad, export it in order to keep the price up. So the U.S., you know, Iran does not provide that much of the global oil supply, nor does Venezuela, for that matter. You know, it's firmly controlled by the UAE and Saudi Arabia in the Middle East. The U.S., by the way, produces more oil than Saudi Arabia and Russia as well. Those are the three big oil suppliers. So it's not oil. The U.S. has, you know, oil reserves for decades going forward. This is about election year. This is about elections and about impeachment distraction and about getting around the War Powers Act. Right? And I believe that Trump, this is exactly what Trump wanted. And these provocations are not over. If Trump has a tight race and Iran does not come to the negotiating table so he can show he forced them to the table, then we're going to see more provocations. This isn't over, right? But the Iranians know that, and I think their strategy is to hold out until after the elections to wait and see. They're not going to kill U.S. service people and attack U.S. bases in a major way. That's just going to fall into the trap Trump wants them to for a larger conflict here. They're going to wait him out. They're not going to negotiate now, ever. That's over. They're going to quietly redevelop slowly and surreptitiously their nuclear development, right? And they want to keep Europe engaged, you see. They want to trade with Europe despite the U.S. sanctions. And Europe wants it, but Europe's afraid of U.S. sanctions on them, which is occurring too. You know, in the era here of late economic empire, very clearly the U.S. is resorting to more aggressive means to maintain, assert its hegemony economically and politically. You know, we've got tariffs, we've got sanctions, which are now common. They never were. Tariffs plus sanctions, you know, plus where necessary, military provocations. So, that's the formula. That's the formula. As the global economy slows down, the U.S. wants to ensure it maintains its share of that shrinking pie, and it's resorting to more aggressive means that it never did before, which means it has to bypass international institutions to do so. And, of course, it is, you know, like the WTO and so forth, right? Iran wants to force the United States to look like the provocateur here, which of course it is. And that's why Iran will continue, I think, not to take the bait. And that's why Trump will continue to try to provoke the situation into a greater conflict. And as he gets closer to the election, if it gets tighter or if he's behind, well, then you will see more and more serious provocations. This is not over, right? And we're going to see a continued debate over the War Powers Act and its limitations, right? Iran may use its proxies elsewhere to stir up trouble as a response. The U.S. Will impose more sanctions, which it already begun to do. Europe will prevaricate and waffle, as it continues to do. Iran will quietly, surreptitiously try to develop its nuclear capabilities. And, as the election unfolds, especially if the U.S. economy slows down as well, that would be a dual motivation for Trump to have a bigger distraction, not just a series of smaller provocations and distractions, right? Or if the impeachment trial unlikely begins to turn against him, okay? So that's my take and my analysis on the political event here, I guess you can say, since it started in 2019, one of the more important political events, although it's sort of lapped over into 2020 and will be continuing here. So what were the other 10 most important or notable political events in the U.S. last year? Last week, we talked about what I consider the 10 most important economic events of 2019 in the U.S. So as I promised, let's follow up with the political events. The first one, of course, here being the events leading up to this confrontation with Iran. The other event, number two, these are certainly not ranked in any way by any means, the impeachment. Ukraine gate and the impeachment, which eventually came down to two charges against Trump by the U.S. House, abuse of power and obstruction. Obstruction is widespread. Obstruction of the executive, the presidency of Congress, the legislature, widespread. We got a lot of examples of this going on. As far as Ukraine gate is concerned, obvious obstructions, blatant obstructions, not even allowing anybody in the executive branch to testify, not allowing any documents or anything to Congress. and the Constitution's very clear. Congress and the House has this oversight power and responsibility and authority, Trump is thumbing his nose at that in the Constitution by refusing to provide any evidence supporting the fact that, you know, what Trump did was to try to peddle U.S. Military aid to Ukraine in exchange for Ukraine helping him go after Joe Biden. Now, I think Biden's probably got his hands dirty over there, or at least his son. But, you know, a whole bunch of politicians swarmed into Ukraine after the coup, the U.S.-led coup in 2014, first U.S. businesses descended, running the economy immediately after that were U.S. State Department officials here, Virginia Nuland, and Europe had their guy, I forget his Ludovicus or something. Those two were running the Ukraine economy right after the coup. And of course, the coup was financed by the United States. Virginia Nuland, who was a Deputy Secretary of State for Eastern Europe at the time, bragged in a conference and presentation over there that got recorded video that the U.S. spent $5 billion to and used, of course, neo-Nazis widespread to stage that coup and overturn that government there and turn it from Russia to the U.S. So it was a U.S.-led coup. And, you know, immediately after that, the hedge funds, equity firms from the U.S. and so forth just sort of flew in mass into Kyiv in Ukraine to see how they could get their hands on some of the assets there and deals. And, you know, Biden's son got put on one of these boards as well. So what's the connection there? Well, there's a lot of politicians who make money in these kinds of deals in the U.S. So, you know, I think, you know, Biden's hands aren't totally clean on this, and time will tell. But the impeachment over Ukraine gate, of course, was a big deal of 2019. But as typical with the Dems, too little, too late. You know, they were outmaneuvered significantly here with the Mueller report. They were originally putting all their eggs in the Mueller report basket, and that report came out in March, but they got totally outmaneuvered by Trump and his forces, and the Mueller report ended up a dead letter pretty much, even though Mueller found extensive obstructions of justice and investigation by Trump over that affair, which was centered on, you know, Trump's and Trump Jr. working with the Russians here in the campaign of 2016. Right. So, well, the Mueller report, you know, would be the other third important political event of 2019. But the Dems, as I said, got outmaneuvered there. They put their trust in a special prosecutor, who, of course, was Mueller, right? A special, rather than an independent prosecutor. You see, the way they got Nixon was they had an independent prosecutor. Well, in the case of Mueller, right, Mueller reported to the Justice Department and reports to Trump, right? So you're asking somebody to turn on their boss. And his investigation was circumscribed by very limited rules, right? In fact, he couldn't issue an indictment by those rules. He could only issue a report on findings to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department could do what they wanted with it. In other words, you got Trump's own appointees are going to rule against him? Well, that didn't happen because Trump and his forces clearly maneuvered to replace two important persons who were blocking Trump's ability to quash the Mueller report. One was this guy, Deputy Justice Department guy Rosenstein, Ron Rosenstein, right? He was sort of a protector of Mueller, able to investigate people. By the way, you know, Mueller never brought Trump to make a statement, take an affidavit, you know. And he didn't even interview Donald Trump Jr., who was in the middle of all this. So he's only a special prosecutor, and he was very careful who he interviewed and took evidence from, but he never took it from the horse's mouth, okay? Well, this guy Rosenstein was moved out early in 2019 someone did a trip on him, leaking, true or not, the fact that when Trump first came in office, Rosenstein said that, we ought to investigate this guy. And that came out and slandered him, and he looked like he wasn't independent anymore. And Trump calls him into the White House, and all of a sudden, Rosenstein is pro-Trump and leaves his job. And I understand he just got a position now in a very lucrative law firm here in Washington, where a lot of these, you do a favor, you get a big private sector job, folks go. So Rosenstein was out of the way, which Trump then gets Jeff Sessions, who recused himself in all this, the attorney general, got him out of the way and puts in his buddy Barr, Bill Barr, who always believed that and argued publicly that, the president should have more power. And by the way, Barr was personal friends with Robert Mueller. You know, their families and everybody were buddy-buddy. All right, so now you got Mueller reporting to Barr, and Rosenstein's out. We get this very, very convenient position by Barr. The Mueller issues his report. Barr quickly issues a one or two pages exonerating the president and saying that, the Mueller report totally exonerates him. Right? And the Democrats are stunned. This occurs last March. They're stunned by all this, and they prevaricate for weeks. And by then, the message is out, and everybody believes that, the Mueller report exonerates Trump. And the Democrats totally outmaneuvered and lose the whole initiative. And then, however, it comes to light with a whistleblower in July that Trump sticks his foot in his mouth again, and we get Ukrainegate, right? And then the Democrats prevaricate, argue amongst themselves, and initiate impeachment late in the year instead of immediately, and run out of time, because now it looks like it's an election year political ploy. So the Democrats, tactically are outmaneuvered time and time again by Trump and the right. But two examples of this were, impeachment and the Mueller fiasco. And they'll probably get outmaneuvered again in 2020 on this whole War Powers Act revisitation. A fourth important development of 2019 politically is this creeping constitutional crisis going on in the U.S. as the executive Trump increasingly ignores the Constitution, established precedences and understandings on how the executive will relate to the legislative, the House of Representatives, in other words. Increasingly, we see, Trump diverts congressional authorized spending for his wall. He just says, Congress said this would be spent on this infrastructure, but no, I'm taking $3.5 billion, whatever it is, I'm going to help build my wall with it. Well, there's no, under the Constitution, whatever bills are passed and revenues are allocated, this taxing and revenue allocation is authority of the House of Representatives, power of the purse, right? That means he can take money on anything that Congress and the House has passed and spend it wherever he wants, spend it on things instead of what Congress has authorized. Well, that's a big undermining of checks and balances, you see. And that's a part of this drift. Declaring national emergency declarations, whenever he wants to, as an excuse for sanctions and so forth. That's an abuse of power. That's a drift. That's a constitutional crisis issue, right? Totally refusing to allow anybody in the executive to testify before a subpoena by the House of Representatives. Well, that's a direct violation, abuse of power, and undermining further significantly checks and balances. And we see this you know, time and time again this past year going on. And Trump, you know, he's drifting towards rule by executive. And he feels, by the way, he can do this because, you know, they've been stacking the courts, the federal courts, and now the Supreme Court. He's got a free hand, pretty much, he thinks, to go ahead now. He's got the courts behind him. You know, the executive has come to dominate the courts. He's packed the courts. Another issue of political development, key here last year, the federal courts, you know, I think something like a third of all the appointees now in the federal district appeals courts are Trump appointees. And of course, now he's got his majority on the Supreme Court, you know, easy majority. So courts packing by the Republican Party, which is really another example of important development that continues here, and that's the conversion of the Republican Party into the Trump-publican Party, right? Anybody in the party that has a different view than Trump's, you know, priorities here or criticizes him quickly gets drummed out, forced out, resigns, decides not to run. The same with his same thing going on in his cabinet here. So courts packing. Neocons have taken over U.S. and domestic foreign policy. Number six, very clearly. The red states continue towards an anti-democracy drift. We see the continued problems with voter suppression, with gerrymandering, supported by the courts, going on throughout last year, which will have big implications for election and electoral college election of the presidency later this year. We see a continued U.S. social and cultural decline last year. 48,000 opioid deaths, almost 40,000 of which are prescribed, right? Suicides at post-1945 peaks, records in the U.S., 38,000 gun deaths, school shootings almost every day. We have school shootings or school gun issues, right? Homeless at record levels, millions, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of kids without any health coverage, a debt crisis, household debt crisis, over $15 trillion households are in debt now, student debt, $1.6 trillion, car debt, $1 trillion, auto debt, $1.2 trillion, mortgage debt, nearly $3 trillion. Mortgage debt and record homeless levels at the same time. Social cultural decline. By the way, you look in Canada, society very much like ours. None of this. These suicides and opioid deaths and so forth. Okay, so that's number seven, number eight. U.S. social cultural decline continues. Trump got his Space Force. This is the foot in the door. And it's going to be with great implications going forward, both for spending and deficits and for safety and World War III, because once you have the Space Force and hypersonic missiles and weapons, you got less than a minute notice before World War III begins. Political party shifts developing, you know, the Trump publicans. Deepening their control of that party. And now we see a fight going on for the soul of the Democratic Party as Sanders and Warren and others are trying to turn it back to what it once was. And the corporate Democrats, the DLCers, the money bags are resisting that. So we got the same thing going on here on the Democratic side now as the U.S. Social political decline continues. And I think that's probably our 10 most important political developments. You know, the Iran confrontation, which begins last year, the impeachment, the Mueller report, U.S. constitutional crisis developing, courts packing, neocons taking over policy, red states anti-democracy drift, U.S. social cultural decline, Trump's Space Force, and political party shifts continuing. Okay. Next week, if there's not some other topic of great import here, I think we're going to look back on the last decade, both economic and political and U.S. and global. The big picture, what's really happened since the crisis of 2008-09 economically and politically as we go into this 2020s decade, which is the key junctural decade, I think, of this century. And we'll have a discussion on that should some other issue not intervene. Okay, that's it for today. Walk the streets a-screaming now.